Now, in depth with Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Friday, August 21st, 2015. It's the Federal News Countdown. The three most important federal news stories of the week is selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. This week, my experts, Steve Bucci of the Heritage Foundation. Dr. Steve, it's great to see you, my friend. Thanks for coming in.
It's always great to be here.
And Brian Clark, the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. It's also great to see you. Thank you for coming in.
Great to be here, Francis. Thank you.
You have each chosen terrific choices for the three most important federal news stories of the week. So we'll start with
number three.
And Brian, your choice at number three is from Defense One. The headline is Predator Drone Maker General Atomics Flying Spy Missions for the Pentagon. This seems to be kind of the next generation of the whole drone conversation. Not entirely unexpected that at some point in time, one of the branches of the military would decide, well, we don't need to actually own them anymore. Is that what we're seeing with this story in your view?
Right. That's part of what we're seeing. So there's a couple of interesting dynamics to this. First of all, I think a lot of people thought we might be, you know, maybe downscoping our drone effort as we, you know, reduce our footprint in the Middle East and begin to, you know, move some of those troops back to the United States. But if anything, we're increasing the drone efforts. So what the department wants to do is increase by 50% the number of drone flights going on worldwide, mostly in the Middle East. And right now, the Air Force is dealing with a significant shortfall in the number of drone pilots, because what it's finding is that these drone missions are really stressful for pilots, because unlike a drone that's automated, where you just tell it where to go and it goes off and does whatever and comes back, these drones are actually remotely piloted vehicles. So you're actually flying it as if it were a remote control aircraft. And when you do that for 8 hours or, you know, whatever a day, it's pretty tiring and stressful just by itself. On top of that, they're doing some of these missions that go do attacks on villages or terrorists, high value targets, which that adds an additional element of stress. So you can imagine the situation where a drone pilot sits down, does an operation, kills a terrorist, turns around, leaves after his shift, and goes off to his kid's soccer game, and he has to be a normal person again. And normally when we send people into combat, there's a period of decompression that you get as you return from the theater, and normally you're there for months, and you come back, and you have some time before you have to return to normal life. Mm-hmm. These guys are having to go back and forth and return to normal life. What the Air Force is finding now is that their attrition is very high in these drone pilots, and they're finding that they're coming up about 60 short per year. Right now, I think they've got a demand for about 300 drone pilots a year, and they're only able to train about 240 of them, I think. Yes. So they're losing about 240 a year, and they need 300 a year, and they're only making 180 new ones. So they got to augment that, and they're turning to industry to do that. So General Atomics is going to be hired to do some of these drone flights. And it's going to start out, it looks like, at about 10 to 15% of them, of the orbits, are going to be flown by General Atomics contractor pilots.
As I read this story, I thought back to the whole Blackwater thing in Iraq. And when, especially when I read this passage, some see this as a first step toward allowing civilian contractors firing weapons on behalf of the military, although the Pentagon is not there yet, and neither is General Atomics. My takeaway from some of the quotes in the story is that maybe it's not that specific episode that is on their minds, but they see a line of demarcation there, maybe as a result of those kinds of events.
Right. There is a lot of resistance, obviously, to having contractors using lethal force on the behalf of the U.S. government. The department's going to try to separate the drone missions that contractors do geographically from areas in which they would be doing attacks on high-value targets or other targets in which you'd be using weapons. The problem will come in when those geographies start to merge and you end up doing what's normally a surveillance mission and you encounter a high-value target. And then the question will be, if you have a weapon available, are you going to use that weapon to take out that high-value fleeting target, or is that guy going to get away? Or am I going to wait and then, you know, get another drone that has a military pilot to come in and take on that mission? Which I think over time there's going to be more and more cases in which that happens, and there's going to be more and more pressure to let the contractor go ahead and take the shot when the opportunity presents itself.
And a more and more of a blurring of those lines. Brian Clark's choice is the third most important federal news story of the week is from Defense One. Predator drone maker General Atomics flying spy missions for the Pentagon. Steve Bucci, your choice at number three is really one of the most talked about stories in the general media of the week, and that is you chose Federal News Radio story, first women to pass Ranger School are Army pilot and military cop. And I appreciated your analysis of this on my program earlier in the week. That's archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. In the time since you and I have talked about this story, and you've had more of a time to think about it, we met the two women who have passed Ranger School, and I think most importantly, heard from some of their male peers who are graduating Ranger School with them, who were very, very eloquent in their discussions and descriptions of what these women accomplished. Any other thoughts and takeaways that you have on this?
Well, the main thing is, you know, we've heard from, for instance, the Command Sergeant Major of the Ranger School. Command Sergeants Major are not known for being politically correct, even if people want them to be. And the Command Sergeant Major said, look, these two women did everything that their male counterparts did. They did it darned well. And it admitted he was very skeptical when this whole thing started. And he said, you know, I watched them. They did what they were supposed to do, and they did it well enough to earn the tab. That's a big compliment from a Command Sergeant Major for two young officers. And I think the accomplishment of these two young women and their 90-plus classmates that went with them, because earning a Ranger tab by anybody is a pretty darned huge accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
It says that I think the Army did it right this time. They established the standard. They stuck to the standard. It appears like they may have even held the whole class to, as rigid of interpretation of that high standard as possible. And these two women did it. Kudos to them. If people can pass the standards without any sort of helping hand, then they deserve the award, and they got it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that says a lot about the quality of the young women and the young men that we get in our military today.
The thing that I enjoyed the most about your analysis earlier in the week is the discussion of the glass ceiling. And this is a significant event. But the more that I read about this and the more that I hear about this, the faster I think that glass ceiling, if it's not entirely broken now, will be dispensed with because of exactly what you just said. I don't think that anybody could look at what has happened with these women and say, well, they bent something or they just wanted to pass a couple, so they passed a couple. I don't think there's anybody that thinks that that's the case anymore, reasonably at least.
If they do, they're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is, as I said on your show earlier in the week, I don't think the glass ceiling is gone, particularly for combat, but this was a necessary step in that process. Maybe not sufficient yet to make the glass ceiling go away completely, but I think we're getting closer to it. The Navy is raising the issue as well. It's the leadership is looking at it, and they're coming to the conclusion, if you can do it, it doesn't matter what your gender, what your color, what your religion is.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to tell you, the military, it isn't perfect. There's still discrimination out there in the hearts of individuals. But for the most part in the military, it's about as close to a meritocracy as you're going to find. And if somebody can do the work, the people on their left and right, that's good enough for them.
We'll talk about some of the other changes that this appears to be generating in some of the other branches later on in the program. But I guess the other big takeaway that I had on this, I wonder if you think the same, is that I've never seen more of a discussion about the role of women in combat, with the most of the tone being, well, they're already doing it anyway, and this is more a formalization of the possibility that women should be eligible to be the frontline folks. But, I mean, Dave Barno and Nora Bensahel of American University had a great piece in Time magazine, and Dave was on with Tom Temin on the morning show this week talking about that very idea. Hey, you know, he experienced this in Afghanistan himself. So that's the part of this that I think is really interesting, where a lot of those women who have already served in combat roles are getting attention.
Well, you know, we fought for the last decade plus two counterinsurgency wars. In counterinsurgencies, there isn't a front line and a rear area as there is in big conventional World War II style
mm-hmm.
combat. So we've had women in transportation units and MP units and in all sorts of support MOSs who got shot at as much, if not more, than some of their infantry counterparts, because The bad guys are smart enough not to tangle with our infantry because they lose all the time when they do that. So they went after these other units. So these young men and women many times had to fight, many times were wounded and killed. We've had young women out with Ranger units and other special ops units to go in, particularly in Afghanistan, to deal with the females that they would run into. So these young girls are fast roping in with the gunfighters. You know what? When you're fast roping in right next to the guys with the guns, you can get shot too.
Mm-hmm.
So they've shown they can do it. They've done it well with courage and just incredible abilities. So I think we're on the road to change that. It doesn't mean every MOS needs to be open today, but I think it's got the leadership thinking of how can we do this when these kids are willing and able to meet the standard.
The third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Steve Bucci. It's from federalnewsradio.com. First women to pass Ranger School are Army pilot and military cop. And you can read that and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important stories of the week is selected by Steve Bucci and Brian Clark. It's the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose. In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Steve Bucci of the Heritage Foundation and Brian Clark of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, and we're up to
number two.
And Brian Clark, your choice at number two is from the Army Times. The headline is Two Women Earn Ranger Tabs in a First for the Army. We talked about this a little bit as part of Steve's selection at number three. But your takeaway from this, coming from your point of view, having experienced, I don't know if integration's even the right word. Is it the right word when it comes to discussing mixing men and women in the military? But you experienced this in your tenure in the Navy.
Right. Yeah, I think, integration is one term you can use. I mean, that's, I think, generally how we described it in the Navy, is women came onto ships for the first time in the, you know, late 70s, early 80s. And so I experienced that in my time in the Navy. And the Navy's experience of it was interesting because women first came on in support ship roles. So the idea would be that, well, women aren't going to be a combat ships because a ship could be put into a combat situation and you don't have the opportunity to take the crew off. And mm-hmm. so if we want to keep women out of combat, we put them onto support ships. So they initially started in these supply ships and other units. And generally, the women that first entered were junior women. So they would have women go to boot camp and then get out of boot camp and go off to a ship. And now you are the one of a few women on the ship, but you're a very junior person. And so if you encounter sexual harassment, sexual assault, poor treatment, a hostile work environment, you don't have anybody to turn to but other men, but men to go and arbitrate or adjudicate that. And women were understandably very uncomfortable with that. And the Navy found that that severely degraded the experience of that first cadre of women that joined or that entered the ship force in, mm-hmm. in the surface Navy back in those days. And that was true as women started to go into other parts of the surface Navy, as we let women get into combat ships like destroyers and cruisers and aircraft carriers. The same dynamic played out where we would let junior women come in and they wouldn't have any role models or mentors to help them along. And they would, you know, experience a hostile environment and not enjoy that and mm-hmm. come away feeling like the Navy didn't really care about them, which in some ways might have been true.
Mm-hmm.
Then when women entered the submarine force here in 2 years ago, women started going into the submarine into the submarine force. The Navy started with officers, with the idea that we've learned from that experience of the aviation and surface Navy. Let's go ahead and try bringing in senior people first. establish a cadre of mentors and leaders that are female that would have peers in the wardroom on the ship. And then we would have junior women start to come on the ship as enlisted personnel. And that's where the Navy's going this next year. Enlisted women will start to go into submarines. And that's been a lot smoother transition and will probably result in a lot smoother integration of those women into the fleet, but then also better experience for them so they don't get out after that first tour feeling like the Navy was a horrible decision for them.
What you're describing to me, it sounds like, is the understanding of building an entire framework for women to serve broadly and not just, well, let's put some people here. What's your experience with the Army doing the same thing, and how will these two women who are now Rangers fit into that framework, do you think, Steve?
Well, I think it's very important. The one young lady is a first lieutenant. The other is a captain. They're both officers who have been out in jobs, have done their work. One is a military policeman, one as a helicopter pilot. They know how to lead already. Ranger schools is a leadership school. That's the purpose of it. It isn't just to produce killers. That's not their job. It's to produce leaders who can lead under stress. These two young ladies showed that they came with the right metal, and they proved it while they were there. When they go out, they're going to be the kind of role models that Brian was talking about was missing in that initial integration of women into the ships. We have them all over the military now. I think as they get more and more opportunities to go to leadership schools like Ranger School, we'll see them continue to grow and blossom, and it'll make the entire force more effective.
Brian, your old boss, Admiral Greener, talked about the possibility of women SEALs this week.
Yeah, exactly. Him and Admiral Losey, who's the head of the Special Warfare Command in the Navy, said that they were willing to look at women going through the Basic Underwater Demolition School, which is the six-month SEAL school that is really the most the largest part of SEAL training. And their idea was that if women can pass through the training, just like with Ranger School, there's no reason why they couldn't join SEAL units, which in the SEAL force, I know SEALs that I know would really appreciate that because just like we were talking about earlier, that women in these forward special ops units are really useful or valuable because they can talk to women and maybe get insight into what's going on in a way that a man couldn't. And so having the ability to have more diversity in your special ops units gives you the ability to maybe get a better intelligence sense of the environment, especially when you're talking about a counterinsurgency operation. So special warfare really is looking to try to bring more women into it to increase their diversity.
What else should we be paying attention to moving forward on this story, Steve, do you think?
I think you need to watch. There'll be some blowback. There'll be incidents that will occur. And what we need to make sure that we don't kill the effort or throw the baby out in the bathwater. If there's a bad egg who tries to throw a stick into the spokes, they need to be dealt with. And really focus on maintaining the standards. Especially at a time when our readiness is already going down in the military, we've got to maintain the standards. That's the difference between causing the military to evolve and using the military just to do a social experiment. We don't really want to do the latter.
The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Brian Clark, is from the Army Times. Two women earn Ranger tabs in a first for the Army. Steve Bucci, your choice at number two is from the New York Times. Iran prepares to lure foreign investors after the nuclear deal. The Iran nuclear deal is not really something in the bailiwick of what I cover on an ongoing basis, but I found this story interesting because of the implications here for other areas besides the State Department and the Department of Defense, for parts of the federal government to keep an eye on what happens as a result of this deal.
You know, if you look at the sanctions that were on Iran prior to this deal going in, it's been probably the most effective sanctions regime that I can remember. It was working. The reason it was working is because all the players, all these foreign countries, sacrificially stuck to the sanctions. At a time when their economies were in the toilet, they gave up the chance to sell stuff to the Iranians. That's pretty amazing, but it had the effect of bringing them to the table. Now, as the sanctions come off, there's a gold rush going on, trying to either get the Iranians to come talk to them, or they're going to talk to the Iranians. We've seen them in Russia. We've already heard rumors of deals with several European arms companies and other industrial suppliers. It's going to be problematic, especially if something does happen to ever get these sanctions back on in these difficult economic times.
It strikes me that this is a pan. That's not fair. This is going to be hard to put back in the box after you open the box. I was going to use Pandora's box. That's not fair. But for this one passage of this article is the reason that the company one of the companies that may wind up being sold as a result of this deal, that the company could put itself up for sale to the highest bidder, foreign or domestic, may seem impossible in a country founded on an anti-Western revolutionary ideology. However, a law passed with little fanfare in 2002 and mostly forgotten since then as sanctions and anti-Western feelings piled up practically rolls out the red carpet to foreign buyers. So the gold rush, the land rush that Steve is talking about does sound entirely possible simply because the Iranian law and the state of their economy almost welcomes it sounds like, Brian.
That's true. And you know, one thing that is interesting here is that a few decades of anti-Western fervor in Iran hasn't really dampened the fact that over time, it's been one of the most educated and most entrepreneurial of the Middle Eastern countries. And so it's interesting is outside of Israel, Iran is really the most likely place for large, rapid economic growth to have occurred. That was tamped down a little bit by the revolution and the subsequent actions on the part of the government and sanctions that were imposed on it. But you can kind of see a groundswell of desire on the part of the population to pursue business, even as they maintain their Muslim ideology and their religious government. So I think what you're going to see is a rapid erosion of this firewall against Western intrusion when it comes to business, because people are going to see that as opportunities. And the Iranians seem to be able to separate in their minds the idea of making money from the Westerners versus buying into their ideology.
And seem to be comfortable with that
separation.
They don't seem to mind the idea of taking money from people whose ideology they don't agree with, which really is the definition of entrepreneurialism, isn't it?
Right.
You take money from whoever's willing to give you the money. The other part of this that I find interesting, Steve, is that there's a fairly wide understanding that the average rank-and-file citizen in Iran doesn't like his government very much. I mean, the regime is not popular. It's not as though these are folks who seem to really like what they're getting from their leaders.
No. As you may recall, there was a revolution in Iran that even preceded the Arab Spring series of revolutions. It got crushed, unfortunately, pretty handily by the Revolutionary Guards and the theocracy that is in power, because those folks are the power. There's not a lot of wiggle room for these other parts of civil society to really get out from under the thumb of the Ayatollahs and the Revolutionary Guard. But there is, that's always been the hope of most folks, the last administration and in this one, that was going to be the thing that would bring about change. Internally, the people would rise up and say, enough's enough. You know, we want to rejoin the world. Unfortunately, and I'll be less polite than you, it appears like we've enabled that government to, release the pressure so that they can stay in charge for a little bit longer.
The ultimate outcome here will be, I think, to see exactly who it is that goes in and buys stuff. My fear is that it turns out to be primarily China. And there won't be entrepreneurs. It won't be Chinese entrepreneurs. It'll be Beijing. And if we see a tightening of that coalition, of that alliance, I don't see how that could wind up being a positive for the United States.
Right. Or positive for Iran. I mean, really, in their long-term interest, they're much better off teaming up with companies that are interested in making money and maybe growing the Iranian economy rather than more of an extraction methodology, which the Chinese would pursue, where they just want to get resources from Iran and then move on.
The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Steve Bucci from The New York Times. Iran prepares to lure foreign investors after the nuclear deal. And you can find that and all of our choices on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Brian Clark and Steve Bucci. It's the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
I'm
It's the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose. The three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Brian Clark and Steve Bucci. And we're up to
number one.
Steve, your choice is the most important federal news story of the week is from Politico. The headline is Judge Says Hillary Clinton's Private Emails Violated Policy. And we're going to set the politics of this aside because they're very complicated. And lots of other people are talking about what all the implications are for the presidential campaign and all that jazz. The passage from this piece that I thought was most striking is a statement by U.S. District Judge Emmett Sullivan at a hearing on a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit seeking access to these records. We wouldn't be here today if this employee had followed government policy. And this has been the way that I have been most fascinated to follow this story. Separate out what her job mm-hmm. was, separate out the personality of the person involved. A State Department employee decided arbitrarily that he or she was not obligated to follow the procedures and policies of the federal government that are in place for retaining records. That's a really bad idea, especially when you consider some of the classified information that was apparently going through that person's inbox. And that's why we find ourselves where we are today, again, separating out all the personality and stuff that's involved.
And that's why I picked this story. You know, in this town, there's a ton of folks who operate with this kind of classified material every day, every minute of every day. They understand it. They follow the rules. There's an occasional hiccup, but you know, 99% of the time, they're doing it exactly the right way. The rest of the city and then the rest of the country, really, it's very confusing. They don't understand it. We had the big thing of what the one report might have been top secret, special intelligence, talent keyhole, no foreign. And remember, like, what the heck is all that mean? You know, this stuff, it's important. You know, it's not just the federal government playing games and trying to keep secrets from the American citizen. This is how we protect our country by keeping this kind of information in the right channels, handled the appropriate way. It isn't just because we're all obsessive compulsives. And to blow that off, for anybody to blow it off and do, you know, whether it's legal, you know, I'll leave that to the lawyers to decide. Is it wise to try and work around the system? No. Brian and I talked before we came on air. This happens. You get on an unclassified network and you really need to, I need to tell Brian about this issue, but we don't have a secure phone. And I say, well, Brian, look, let's talk around it. That never works.
Uh-huh.
It always ends up letting something out that shouldn't get out. It's inappropriate. It's the kind of thing mature leaders should never do, because it sets the example for everybody under them. And that's the problem we're facing right now.
Another part of this that jumped out at me, Brian, is kind of a summation of the way that a lot, I think, of the general population sees the federal government in general, not specifically Secretary Clinton, not particularly the State Department. The judge expressed irritation when an attorney for the Justice Department said he didn't know whether the FBI, a Justice Department agency, was actually in possession of Clinton's server or thumb drives on which her attorney stored copies of her emails. You're a Justice Department attorney? You can't tell me, the judge said. I need to get an answer. We're tiptoeing on the head of a pin because there's only one government. That's the statement. That's the money statement, I think, in this whole story. And it's the broader issue than Secretary Clinton's emails. It's that there's one little pocket here that right. doesn't know what this other little pocket over here is doing.
Right. And that's also an example of, you know, apparently some of the controversy around the classification of this has mm-hmm. to do with what one department considers to be classified versus what another department considers to be classified. And in general, you know, Steve was saying, if something comes off of a certain intelligence system, it is by definition classified at a certain level. But then as it makes its way through multiple layers of communication and interpretation, it sort of may lose that pedigree. And one department may say, well, that thing's, you know, now that information has now been sanitized to the point where it's really not classified anymore. And another may say, no, that's very clearly classified because it refers to some, some technical method that we use to obtain the information.
Mm-hmm.
So you get two parts of the government that can't even agree on what's classified. And then here you got the issue of just being able to communicate with each other on a pretty important issue of the transition of that material from an unsecure location to a secure location, you would think that that would happen very quickly, and that, you know, one belly button would be put in charge of, you know, you make sure this happens and then report back to me when it's done, which is how you might handle it in a military unit. You would say, you know, this needs to get fixed. You're in charge of going to fix it. Come back to me and tell me when it's completed. I don't care who you have to talk to and who you have to coordinate with, but you're responsible for making it happen. Here, clearly, you've got multiple chains of command involved, and your responsibility has been diffused among multiple people. And I think that's the frustration of the public with the government, is that no single person is responsible for anything.
Mm-hmm. Steve, this story has really reignited, I think, in this town, kind of a subterranean conversation about exactly how agencies are doing records management. It's not real high profile. It's certainly not sexy, but it can be rather mundane. But I'm starting to hear more talk about it without people even mentioning the controversy around Secretary Clinton. Just, oh yeah, we might not have been doing such a great job of maintaining records overall, not just emails, right, not just servers and private emails and all that jazz, but just the whole point overall that agencies are supposed to be working on this on an ongoing basis and being very careful and deliberate about how these records are being sent to the National Archives.
And, you know, we have the Freedom of Information Act, which puts a lot of responsibility. When you get one of those requests, you've got to answer it, and you've got to do the searches to find the answers to those questions. Or if you get a question from a congressman or a senator, you've got to come up with the answer. Technology has given us an incredible ability to archive all this stuff, to make it searchable, to be able to find it. Unfortunately, that same technology has caused us to create so much more of it.
Mm-hmm.
And every jot and tittle, it's just we've got potentially warehouses full of electronic stuff that has on a small thumb drive what used to be in a warehouse.
Yep.
It's just incredible, and we've got to do a better job. We still have a lot of legacy attitudes and systems towards this sort of thing, but it's got to be disciplined. And just saying, well, put everybody on the same standard is probably not the answer. We saw putting everybody's, you know, SF-86 at OPM, not necessarily
yeah, that
a great
idea. Yeah,
didn't
work idea, out so well.
But we've got to do a better job at this. And this has nothing to do with politics. It has to do with managing the data through which we run the U.S. federal government and the defense of that this nation. We got to get it right.
A quick FOIA story. A colleague of mine who's no longer here submitted a FOIA request to the Department of Defense, and I don't remember even what the material was for, in early 2012, and we got it last week. So, I mean,
yeah.
Brian, your eyes got real big when I said that. Policy-wise, legally, no, it didn't meet the standard. But honestly, I can't say that it really that it could have been any faster than that. It wasn't a particularly complex request, but just because of the sheer volume and the complexity of whatever was in the queue before this, who knows what all of the causes for that are. Steve Choice is the most important federal news story of the week from Politico. Judge says Hillary Clinton's private emails violated policy. That and all of our choices on this week's Federal News Countdown are archived and linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news story of the week is selected by Brian Clark. It'll wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose. You're listening to the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Steve Bucci and Brian Clark. And Brian, your choice at number one this week is from Foreign Affairs. The title is Obama and the Middle East Right-Sizing the U.S. Role. I love that word right-sizing as it applies to foreign policy in general. With a project that I was actually telling both of you about during the break, a book that I'm working on about the future of America's role on the world stage. And the theme that I'm hearing from leaders, from administrations of both parties, from uniformed military leaders, from diplomats, people of all stripes who care about the future of the United States in the world. Right-sizing, if not explicitly used as a term is kind of the theme of what I keep hearing. Right. What struck you about this particular piece and what it says about where we're headed, Brian?
Well, I was interested because we're heading into the final year of President Obama's term in office. We are dealing with a lot of problems in the Middle East right now. There's the Iranian negotiations that are happening. So clearly there's a lot of events occurring in the Middle East that would indicate that the policies that President Obama has pursued during his time in office are reaching some kind of, you know, culmination, if you will. And what I thought was very interesting about Mark Lynch's take on it was he essentially says that President Obama is successfully implementing the foreign policy that he articulated when he first ran for office. And then upon entering office about he calls it right sizing. That's what we're talking about here. But what President Obama has done is look to reduce the U.S. footprint in the Middle East militarily, reduce the amount of U.S. engagement in the Middle East, and rely on allies to a much greater degree, and rely on diplomatic and economic tools to a much greater degree in our actions within the Middle East. So it's a dramatic change in our role there, because for the last, you know, three decades, we've been involved militarily to an increasing degree in the Middle East. And the countries in that region have grown used to that. And that's become sort of the de facto balance of power is the U.S. and all these other players. Mm-hmm. And he's been trying to extract the U.S. militarily and then force these other players to balance against one another. And I think a lot of us in the foreign policy community maybe didn't think through what the implications of that would be. What would the Middle East look like if the U.S. were to really remove itself? Now, mm-hmm. some you know, anticipated this and said the vacuum that would be created would result in a disorder and instability. And you've seen that today. But fundamentally, it kind of gets at this question of what is the American role in the world and what does it mean to be or for American to be a leader in the world? Does it involve a significant engagement in the world, both militarily and non-militarily? Or does it involve some kind of role model, role where you act as the shining city on the hill, but you don't actually get that involved in what's happening down the valley?
It's as I read this piece, I thought back to some of my theism classes in college. It might be a conversation superficially, but I thought of the idea of the act of God versus the deist theory of things, where there's just a big God and there's really no personal communication and no interaction, Steve. And that's kind of the model that I hear Brian portraying, is there's this big kind of amorphous presence, and the presence is there and responsible for some of what's going on, but not really involved in what's going on a day-to-day basis.
I have a problem with that model, whether we're talking about God or we're talking about
I'm not politics. Saying it's right or wrong. Yeah, it's just theories that people talk about.
I think that's a very dangerous model to use to apply to politics. I mean, this stuff is so unstable. I mean, you look at the uncertainty among our allies and even among our adversaries as to what the heck is America going to do. And even people who don't like us or don't like our degree of involvement in the world, once we've pulled back, they're like, oh, geez, this is, you know, really uncomfortable. And it causes them to miscalculate. Sometimes they overreach. Sometimes they don't do enough. America needs to lead. We don't need to be the world's policeman. But just pulling out of the Middle East and just being, you know, sort of benign neglect and trying to just influence on the margins, the world's too messy and too dangerous for us to take that chance. Mm-hmm. And we have vital national interests in that region between our allies and businesses and everything else that I don't think we can really afford to play that role or to not play the role that we've tried to play since the end of World War II.
Brian, what does a healthy partnership between the United States and any other country who chooses to be our ally look like to you?
Well, it would involve military investments on both sides. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, it's meant that the U.S. has the predominant role militarily and economically. And I think what maybe a healthier relationship might be a more even burden sharing. But one thing that we're finding is that relying on partners to provide more the bulk of the military capabilities doesn't work, both because they're not willing to invest in them, but also because they're not always responsible in how they use them. Mm-hmm. And so you look at the example of the Middle East today, and the administration was trying to get the Middle Eastern partners to take on more of a role in the war against ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
And you're seeing now you've got a variety of Middle Eastern countries carrying out their own independent operations against ISIS, sometimes pursuing their own political objectives. So Saudi Arabia is fighting in Yemen, which is really intended to deal with some of the rebels that they've never liked in the first place, as opposed to really dealing with the instability. You've got the Qataris and the Omanis fighting over in Syria. And Turkey now is joining the fight. And that's, you know, good from just a burden sharing perspective. But it's bad from a perspective of they're not all unified in what they're trying to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And they're not looking after the best interests of the Syrian people, for example. Mm-hmm. They're looking after their own political interests and going after targets that they've been wishing to attack for a long time. So this is the problem with America shifting the burden onto its allies, is because you lose that unity of command and you lose that sense of looking after the people you're looking to protect.
We can talk about the worldwide implications and the national defense and national security implications of this for a long time. One of the things I keep hearing in the conversations that I have with folks about this, though, emanates from Capitol Hill, and that is the uncertainty. You mentioned uncertainty a few minutes ago, Steve, but it's the uncertainty that leaders, both allies and adversaries, see coming off Capitol Hill when there are conversations about should we have 450,000 soldiers or should we have 425,000? Should we have, what are the numbers, 320 ships in the fleet or 280 ships in the fleet?
Right,
in the neighborhood.
Right.
Those kinds of conversations cause people around the world to say, we don't know what we're going to get out of the United States this year, and we're not even sure what we're going to get out of the United States in the coming decade. And it strikes me that drives uncertainty as much as what our response is to a particular event or not. Is that fair to say, Steve?
You're dead on. I mean, the administration tends to look at the Iran deal, for instance, and say, well, the only one that doesn't really like it is Israel. Well, that's not true. The Saudis don't like it. The Turks don't like it. The Jordanians are scared to death. They may not be squawking as much as the Israelis, but, you know, Mr. Netanyahu is a little more outspoken than some of those other leaders.
Mm-hmm.
But that uncertainty, you know, when the Economist puts on their cover, you know, what will America be willing to fight for?
Mm-hmm.
That's a bad sign in the world.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Brian Clarks from Foreign Affairs, Obama and the Middle East, Right-Sizing the U.S. Role. All the stories from this week's Federal News Countdown archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming on the program again. As always, it's terrific to see both of you. And the Federal News Countdown returns next Friday on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio.
WFED Washington, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTLP FM HD2 Braddock Heights Frederick, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy Athletics.